General Metcalf, distinguished visitors, ladies and gentlemen, I feel honored and fortunate to have been selected to participate in this series of lectures. This morning and this afternoon, I participated in going through the whole exhibit here, and I was just overwhelmed with the immensity of the project, and I was particularly overwhelmed when I saw the airplane similar to the one I flew on December 7th, reproduced. I felt like I was back there 56 years ago, 57 years ago. I've divided this presentation into four sections. One is the dedication of this presentation. Two is my introduction to the Army Air Corps. Three is the 50th anniversary symposium conducted by the United States Department of Parks at Pearl Harbor the first week of December 1991. And fourth, the events leading up to the Japanese attack on Oahu and my actual experiences on December the 7th, 1941. I dedicate this presentation to Gordon Sterling, my flying school classmate, roommate at Wheeler Field, and friend who gave his life in combat on December 7th, 1941, and to Lou Sanders, my squadron commander, since deceased, and to John Thacker, the fourth member of our flight of P-36s, who took off from Wheeler Field during the attack. John's guns were jammed, and he was unable to engage in combat. My introduction to the Army Air Corps in June 1940, I was preparing to graduate from Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania when an Army pilot recruiting team came through and offered a, quote, no strings attached physical. If we passed the physical, we would be eligible to attend Army Flying School. At that time, only college graduates were accepted for flying. I went home, and I was working for my father, who was a decorator. I wasn't very excited about that particular job. And the 1st of July, I received a telegram stating that I had passed the physical and would be attending primary pilot training at Gunter Army Base in Alabama in mid-July, if I so chose. I felt we were inevitably being drawn into the war in Europe, and it would be to my best interest to select my role in the service rather than being subject to a draft. So I accepted in a return telegram. My primary training, as I said, was at Gunter Army Base in Alabama, and the basic and advanced training were conducted at Maxwell Army Base in Montgomery, Alabama. During that flight training, I flew the PT-11, which was a bi-wing airplane with hard rubber wheels, and the PT-13, the BC-1A, and the AT-6. In the last weeks of our training, we heard that Pan American Airlines was expanding its routes, flying military supplies to Europe, and would be recruiting pilots from our class. Many of us were excited about this. Incidentally, those who were selected retired as chiefs of various overseas routes and vice presidents of Pan Am. I missed that. Just before the Pan American recruiters arrived, my roommate was killed night flying. His name was Bob Thompson, and I was directed to escort his body to Andover Academy campus in Massachusetts, where his parents resided. When I returned to Maxwell, the Pan American people had made their selections and left. I went to Colonel Sneed, our commanding officer, and asked him if there wasn't some way I could get on that list. He said no. All remaining pilots were going overseas, to Puerto Rico, Panama Canal, Philippines, and Hawaii, and that I could have my choice of assignment. After brief discussion, my romantic primal urges got the best of me, and I chose Paradise of the Pacific, Hawaii. With four other pilots assigned to Hawaii, I embarked on the old Army transport, the A.T. Grant, from the Presidio in San Francisco, and 5 days later docked in Honolulu. Gordon Sterling and I were assigned as pursuit pilots to Wheeler Field, and the others to Hickam Air Base as bomber pilots. In the summer of 1941, when I arrived there in Hawaii, the services were in the doldrums. Memories of World War I had dimmed. Here we were out in the Pacific, 7,000 miles from any threat. There appeared to be no particular urgency about preparing for war. Pilots like myself had primarily flying duties and secondary minor squadron duties. We had a first sergeant who ran everything. Things haven't changed. Lots of golf was played at Schofield Barracks, which was next door, and swimming at military beaches like Haleiwa and Fort De Russey were the finest in the world. It was an idyllic life. I just turned 22. I had a Chevy convertible paid for, doing what I wanted to do, fly, and not a worry in the world. We had a mixed bag of aircraft at Wheeler Field. Open cockpit P-26s, which we flew with long trailing silk white scarves, Curtiss P-36s, and newly arrived P-40s. Also in the inventory were some World War I and shortly subsequent to World War I bomber and observation aircraft, wooden-framed bi-wing bombers and observation aircraft. There was no way to rid ourselves of these obsolescent aircraft, and General Davidson, our commander, put out the word that if these aircraft were unintentionally damaged beyond repair, parts were non-existent, there wouldn't be much of a pilot inquiry. George Welch, who was one of the pilots who got off from Haleiwa Field, not Wheeler Field, and shot down four enemy aircraft on the December the 7th, promptly ditched one of these in the surf at Haleiwa. I landed in a strong crosswind with which the landing gear could not cope. The gear collapsed, and the top wing collapsed on me as well, like the old one-horse shrey. I was sitting in the midst of a bunch of wood splinters and lacquered linen. Pilot error was not found. Our flying duties then consisted of cross-country flights to other islands and high-altitude flight training using oxygen. The way we used oxygen then was a rubber tube tipped with a cigarette holder made of wood was clenched between our teeth. A steady blast of cold oxygen dried out the roof of my mouth, and I always landed with a sore throat after one of these high-altitude flights. Aerial gunnery training consisted of firing at towed banners, and for ground gunnery, we had no targets on land. Instead, the flight leader would fly down close to the water, open his canopy, and toss out a paper sack full of aluminum powder. This would form a slick on the water, which we would fire at. This could be a dangerous, very dangerous procedure. At one time, I was doing this just off of Haleiwa, and I was the flight leader at that time. I was about 15 feet off the water. I opened my canopy to pick up the bag and throw it out, and as I picked it up, the bag burst in the cockpit and exploded in the cockpit with this aluminum powder and blinded me. I had had a glimpse just before the bag burst of the runway, at the beginning of the runway at Haleiwa, and I was wiping my eyes off and trying to see my way down there to land at Haleiwa, and the people on the flight surgeon who was on duty down there in his Jeep and the emergency people saw this explosion in my cockpit, and they thought I'd had a fire of some kind. And I managed to touch down on the runway, and the flight surgeon was racing along in his Jeep beside me, and he saw my face was all covered with a silvery color as though I had been burned. And I finally brought the plane to a stop, and fortunately I was able to get out of that thing successfully. Lots of time was spent in formation flying and mock combat. And we did a lot of buzzing, too. And the reason, for any of you that have seen this airplane that I flew down there, there's a large number, 86, on the fuselage. And the purpose of this was to identify this aircraft if the civilians were upset about us blowing their laundry off the lines and when we were buzzing our girlfriend's house or something like this. And these numbers were called buzz numbers. And there were huge numbers painted on the fuselage so they could spot us, call up the Wheeler Field and report that we were buzzing their place. Most of the pilots were second lieutenants. Promotions were few back then. The squadron commanders were first lieutenants. And every evening at officers' mess, we were required to appear in formal attire consisting of snappy, tight-fitting white mess jackets and a black bow tie, all of them carefully tailored by Japanese tailors. Our flying suits as well were tailored by the Japanese because we didn't have any flying suits per se. We had what we used instead of flying suits were just the working clothes that was used by all personnel. And we had little to do there, so that both Schofield Barracks, which was next door, and Wheeler Field were spick and span. The buildings were all in beautiful shape, every blade of grass was manicured, and it was really lovely the way those bases were maintained. I wasn't going to tell this little story, but I decided I'd risk telling it to you. When the Matson-line ships would come in, the Lurline and the Matsonia were two of them that I remember, and they would bring in girls from the mainland and tourists. I wasn't interested in the tourists, but I was interested in the girls. And when they appeared off of Diamond Head, we'd know about it, and we could buy leis at Waiheawa, right outside of Wheeler Field. And we'd buy pikaki leis, and we'd buy orchid leis for 35 to 50 cents a lei. And we'd get a bunch of them, and we'd jump in the airplane, fly down, and catch the Lurline or the Matsonia off of Diamond Head, and we'd buzz them, and then we'd toss these leis out and hoping that they would land on the ship. And then we'd go back to fly back to Wheeler Field, get into our convertibles, and manage to get down there before the ship docked so that we'd be there there was a hostess who took care of the girls to introduce them when they came off the ship. 7 months of bliss. And then the other shoe dropped. This is about the symposium that we had in 1991, because it sort of leads into what happened on December 6th and December 7th, which I'm going to tell you subsequently. In the first week of December 1991, on the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, the United States Department of Parks conducted a symposium at Pearl Harbor. They invited those who had actively participated in the defense of Oahu to recount their experiences at that dreadful time in the history of our country when the Japanese made a sneak attack on Oahu. I say Oahu instead of the usual context of Pearl Harbor. Although Pearl Harbor received by far the majority of attention and damage by Japanese planes, the rest of the island certainly did not escape unscathed. The Army Air Corps stations at Wheeler Field and Bellows Field were badly damaged, with most of their aircraft and hangars destroyed and many men killed. The Army Air Corps was the only unit able to mount a counterattack in the air with the destruction of some 12 Japanese aircraft. The balance of the Japanese aircraft shot down were accounted for by anti-aircraft fire. It was an extremely emotional time at the symposium as participants told of their experiences. Survivors of the Arizona and other ships, men from Wheeler Field and Bellows Field, told hair-raising tales of heroic action. The audience, as well as speakers, were shedding tears. Japanese survivors of the attack on Oahu were also present and told their stories with much apology. A Japanese engineer who had developed a shallow-running torpedo told of the many attempts to produce this strategic weapon, because without it, the attack could not be carried out. The reason being that Pearl Harbor has mostly shallow waters except for the channels and docking area. And up to that time, torpedoes could not run just below the surface. When he stopped for questions, a lady in the audience stood and said, "My son was on the Arizona, and you killed him." It ended up with the engineer apologizing, begging forgiveness, with tears running down his face. The whole audience was a sea of handkerchiefs. Events leading up to the attack on Oahu. What follows here is my presentation to the 50th anniversary symposium of the events leading up to the attack and my actual experiences on December 7th, 1941. I preface my remarks with the observation that 50 years after the event, time has affected my memory regarding some details, similar to looking into a tarnished mirror where some reflections are crisp and clear, others blurred. I had not attended any past Pearl Harbor reunions, and my thoughts have not dwelled on December 7th activities in the intervening years. So my memory of these events dimmed. Historians at the symposium helped revive that memory to some degree. For example, it was not until David Akins, a historian, asked me if I had written records of that day that I recalled that I had kept a diary and made entries on that day. Unfortunately, only now have I put in writing my activities on December 7th. I have been interviewed occasionally through the intervening years, but those questions were not directed towards an historical narration of the events, but emphasized, for example, interest in the fact that I had fought in pajamas and what color they were, the number of bullet holes in my plane. I had also forgotten, until I saw the combat report of that day, that an aircraft had tried to ram me during combat. That incident was recalled by a People's Magazine interviewer who informed me that on the December issue of 1991 that I would find this issue very interesting. And I said, well, what did you put in it that you did not interview me about? And he said, well, you'll find that out. He was able to locate the Japanese pilot who had tried to ram me. He was still alive. He was living in Japan. He was suffering from liver disease and was unable to attend at the 50th reunion. But he recounted the event, confirming my report. He stated that he had run out of ammunition and his engine was failing. He did not think he could get back to the carrier and decided to take someone down with him, namely me. However, he did make it back to the carrier, and upon touchdown, a cylinder fell out of his engine. December 6th, 1941. On Saturday, December 6th, we completed inspection of aircraft, an end-of-the-week custom in the Army. All aircraft at Wheeler Field were carefully lined up wingtip to wingtip on the ramp in front of the hangars. One squadron, the 47th Squadron, flying P-40s, had been detached to Heli-Ever for gunnery training and was absent from that lineup. That's where Ken Taylor and George Welch were able to take off in P-40s from Heli-Ever and really accounted for themselves. Each pilot and crew chief stood at attention in front of their aircraft as General Davidson, the commander, trooped the line. All of us waited for this tedious function to end so we could get into other activities. The married men to their families for picnics at Haleiwa or Fort DeRussy, military beaches. The bachelors to Waikiki Beach, where a new batch of girls were in from the mainland debarking from the Lurline, looking for fun and romance. There was little tension on the island. We were on an anti-sabotage alert with guards at strategic municipal facilities, such as power stations and water pumping stations. The planes, which sporadically in the past had been dispersed to revetments around the field, had been left on the ramp, lined up wingtip to wingtip this particular day due to the shortage of guard personnel. The pilots, each in his convertible that he had purchased after graduating from flying school, were in this mass exodus. Joe Powell, a friend of mine, a pilot, and I had dates in Honolulu, a short half-hour drive from Wheeler Field. We picked up our dates, we bought beer, drove to Makapu'u Point for body surfing. We settled down in blankets, turned on our 30-pound Zenith transoceanic portable radio, listening to mainland music fading in and out. This was something rather new in that scene, that great... I don't know if any of you remember that Zenith portable back there in the 40s, but it weighed a ton, and it did pick up transoceanic music, and it wasn't a bad thing to have. It was better than nothing. 1 year later, while I was stationed in Port Moresby, New Guinea, in a hot poker game, I anteed this radio, not having any cash, and lost it. 10 minutes later, we had an air raid, jumped in the slit trenches, and a bomb blew that radio apart. In the afternoon, we headed for Cow Cow Corners, a fast food place like McDonald's, and later went to Trader Vic's, which was a landmark nightclub and the only one I was aware of in Honolulu. At Trader Vic's, we consumed several of his one-to-a-customer zombies. Today, the thought of having just one of these drinks would send me quickly looking for Maalox and aspirin. There were 5 different kinds of rum in there. We danced the night through, dropped the girls off, and headed for Wheeler Field about 2 a.m. Sunday morning, December the 7th. The road that wandered up to Wheeler Field from Honolulu passed high above Pearl Harbor, giving us a panoramic view of the whole harbor. It was brilliant, starlit night, and all the ships in the harbor were festooned with flags and lights from stem to stern, reminding me of Tivoli in Copenhagen or Revere Beach outside of Boston, my hometown. Joe was snoozing on the way back. I nudged him awake and I said, "Did you ever see so many lights at Pearl Harbor?" He looked sleepily and commented, "What a target that would make," and promptly fell back to sleep for the remainder of the trip to Wheeler. December 7th, 1941, about 7:30 a.m. The bachelor's offices at Wheeler Field lived in barracks at the main entrance, nicknamed Splitter City. It being Sunday, everyone off duty was sleeping late. I awakened to a nature call, and while idly standing in the latrine, looking out the window overlooking the hangar line, which was about 300 yards away, I saw an airplane dive and drop an object, which on impact blossomed into a huge bomb blast, quickly followed by others. My first impression was the Navy was up to realistic tricks. In the past, we would buzz Navy fields on Sunday mornings, drop paper sacks of flour simulating bombs, as well as awakening a sleeping base. And, of course, the Navy reciprocated. And we had just done this the previous week, so we kind of expected it. But these were not sacks of flour. And when the plane pulled up from its dive and I saw that meatball, that rising sun on the wing, I yelled down the hall that we were being attacked by Japs. I strapped on my web belt and .45 caliber pistol over my pajamas, pulled on my boots, and I ran for the flight line. Outside the barracks, small date palms had recently been planted, and I hid behind a 3-foot-tall one, taking shots at the Jap planes as they sped by, strafing us. I ran down to the flight line, and it was chaos. Ammunition was exploding in the hangars, fires everywhere. An airplane would explode and in turn ignite the plane next to it like a row of Chinese firecrackers. The only planes not burning at that time were a few P-36s. I jumped into one, got it started, and with an armorer who came out of nowhere and whose name I unfortunately never learned, sat in the wing with the belts of 30 caliber and 50 caliber ammunition hanging on his shoulder as I taxied over to one of the earthen revetments surrounding the airfield. Lou Sanders, my squadron commander, Othniel Norris, John Thacker, also taxied airplanes to the revetments. The P-36 that I flew had no armor plate protection behind the pilot, and was armed with one 50 caliber and one 30 caliber machine gun firing through the propeller, and they fired at about the same speed as a funeral march cadence. In the process of arming the plane with ammunition, we would jump off the wing as a Jap bomber approached to gain whatever protection the earthen revetment offered. The Japanese bomber either had no forward-firing guns or had run out of ammunition, dove steeply over the target and pulled up sharply so that his tail gunner would have a free field of fire and not shoot off his vertical stabilizer. We hopped from one side of the revetment to the other to keep out of harm's way. The planes were well protected by the revetments, and they didn't get any fire. During a lull in the attack, we took off in formation, Sanders in the lead, and his wingman Gordon Sterling, having somehow substituted for Norris. I was Thacker's wingman. After takeoff, while climbing for altitude, we armed our guns by pulling an arming lever in the cockpit for each gun. This lever was pulled back to our ears, and then it was allowed to snap forward, and it would place a bullet in the chamber. When I did this with my 50 caliber, the gun started firing by itself. When I charged 30 caliber, it wouldn't fire at all. I was really loaded for bear. We headed for Bellows Field, which was under attack. We had been directed to head for there, climbing through the clouds over the Koolau mountain range. We received radio instructions to divert to Kaneohe Bay Naval Station. At about 9,000 feet, we spotted some dive bombers attacking Kaneohe and dove to attack them. Above us were more Zeros. I saw Lou engage a plane and fire at it, and I also saw one of our planes, probably Gordon Sterling, diving and smoking with a Japanese aircraft on his tail. Out of the right corner of my eye, I saw a plane coming across in front of me, and I let the 50 caliber arm slide into firing position, and the gun started firing by itself. And I saw spurts of bullets marks as they stitched the fuselage, and smoke started to come out from the plane. As I pulled up, I saw another plane coming head-on towards me, not firing, but seeming to want to ram me. I pulled up sharply to avoid collision, and at that instant, all hell broke loose. My canopy was shot off. I felt the plane shudder, and I lost control and tumbled into the clouds below. Finally, I got the plane under control and found that I had no rudder control, only aileron and elevator controls. I had to push my stick into the far right corner and add maximum trim to keep the plane level. Unknown to me at that time, my hydraulic lines had been severed, my tailwheel had been shot off, and one main gear tire with bullet holes in it, included with two 20-millimeter explosive cannon shells that had buried themselves in the radio equipment behind the pilot's seat, saving my life as there was no armor plate. 7.7-millimeter bullets had peppered my catwalk on both sides. While ducking through the clouds on my way back to Wheeler, I finally had the courage to gingerly touch the top of my head to see how badly I was injured. I was not wearing a helmet, only a headset. To my relief, I found only shredded plexiglass from the canopy mixed with my hair and no blood or injuries. When I popped out of the clouds on the way back towards Wheeler Field, Lou Sanders pulled up beside me. With a look of concern on his face, I indicated I was okay, and together we flew back to Wheeler Field. It appeared there were no more Japs around. As we made our downwind turn over Schofield Barracks, we encountered very heavy friendly fire, but fortunately escaped being hit. On base leg, my cockpit indicator showed the wheels were not down. I managed to get them pumped down and locked just as I touched down. Another thrill. Wheeler Field had no runways at that time, simply a grass field, still wet with morning dew. Without rudder, brakes, or tailwheel, I ground-looped a couple of times before cutting my engine and coming to a stop. As ground crews rushed to my plane to see if I was okay, I sat benumbed in the cockpit for moments, unable to take in the rush of events. The attack, my close brush with death, destruction and fire surrounding me. I glanced around, the hangar still burning, the planes sitting in smoldering rows with their backs broken, engines pointing to the sky. Only then did fear enter the equation. The adrenaline had worn down. I looked at my watch, 50 minutes since takeoff. I shakily got out of the plane, walked over to my room and traded my pajamas, probably not just wet from sweat, for a flying suit, and returned to the flight line. Days later, I checked my plane in the hangar and counted some 450 holes in it. Lou Sanders got to 500. They were still able to use the engine for another plane. The rest of the plane was scrap. We were not at all sure that the Japanese would not return. We felt so vulnerable. So everyone having a car equipped his trunk with a carbine, ammunition, and sea rations to be in a position to continue guerrilla fighting in the mountains if it came to that. We almost had no airplanes to defend with. I finally dumped the sea rations months later when I found them in my trunk. For days after the attack, we looked from Wheeler Field towards Pearl Harbor, some 12 miles away. We saw a curtain of black smoke with boiling geysers of fire filling the horizon. I had a feeling of deja vu when I saw on television a few years back the scenes of Kuwait oil fires after Desert Storm. The scene was so similar to Pearl Harbor. We had expected a follow-up attack by the Japanese because we were vulnerable, but of course that never materialized. Now we were on a war footing, and that country club life must have been just a dream, perhaps too many zombies. Thank you.